Robert Drysdale is a legend, widely regarded as one of the finest, if not the finest, practitioner, grappler, competitor in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and MMA. And for reasons that will become clear, he is today talking to me. So, Robert, hello, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Paul. Thanks for having me. Thank you for the kind words. And yeah, I'm excited to be here.
So we're both on lockdown. In different parts of the world, in different time zones. And we were planning to meet, we were hoping to meet this summer because I am a professor of cultural studies at Cardiff University and I run a conference every year on martial arts studies. So we get all the academics from all over the world to come and talk about their different research projects and different interests. And you wanted to come and share your new film. Which you're just in product, it's just finishing production now, isn't it? The Closed Guard. And we were going to meet in Marseille. We're going to hopefully have a screening and have a Q&A with the director and everything. So that's not going to happen. So this is our us meeting each other now, isn't it?
Yes, unfortunately it didn't work out. Like I was, excited about, speaking to a crowd that's not a crowd that I normally be reaching out to. I've been so immersed in the BJJ slash MMA world for the past, 20 years of my life, really, that, it's been good in a lot of ways, but like I'm ready to meet new people and like reach out to a different audience that's probably, it may or may not be familiar with the development of martial arts in Brazil. I think it's a sort of a hot topic, like there was a revolution that went on in Brazil and then later in the UFC, and we've only heard about it, but we don't know a lot about it, right? So so that's why it was exciting to me to be able to share some of this information with people. And I was really looking forward to going to France and the convention, but unfortunately it didn't work. Maybe next time. I'm still open to it. I'm sure that there will be others.
So it's a let me just share the screen. So it's a historical so that's Robert Drysdale's Wikipedia page. And if these things will move, where's the Closed Guard movie? So that's there's a lot of discussion about. So people who are in Brazilian jiu-jitsu circles will already be aware that this is in production because it's the internet's alive with it. But for people who haven't read this yet, I mean your website on the closedguardmovie.com, it explains that it's a historical survey that brings together interviews, fact, and evidence to film that changes our perception of our own history. Now, I've only seen a teaser for it. You sent me a kind of a private link, kind of showing me some of the type of material that's going to be in there. There's going to be a lot of historical expose, isn't there? There's going to be a lot of new light cast on the historical emergence of Brazilian jiu-jitsu.
Yes, that is correct. Like it's we wanted to do something that was a little outside of the oral tradition side of things. Problem with the history of not only Brazilian jiu-jitsu but mixed martial arts MMA in Brazil is that like it's always been based off the testimony of very few people, and depending on the period you're talking about, you're really talking about Carlos Gracie Sr., right? So it all goes back to his testimony and his account of how things developed. And it was a topic he didn't talk about a whole bunch. He only mentioned it a few times, and I suspect because he wasn't that comfortable talking about it, because there were some omissions, some distortions, and he was human. He was not. I think part of the problem of this discussion is that we seem to have this almost, this sort of worship for some figures in history that like, oh, this guy would have never lied. And they were human like me and you were. They struggled financially and they had problems too. And at some point they did what they felt was the best for them at the time with no concern for history. People when they're acting in the present, history is not really something they're concerned with. No one's concerned with collecting records of everything they do. No one's concerned with people are going to think of them 100 years down the road. You're trying to get your bills paid right now. I think Carlos Gracie was no exception to that. So, if long story short, it all goes back to him,
Okay.
right? And other family members. Like if you look at Hayla Gracie's biography of her father, it is very, very, family friendly, obviously. You got to give her a lot of credit. She opened up the family annals to a lot of like personal stories and things that I suspect other members of the family were not happy with. She did her best to be honest. I'll give her a lot of credit for that, but it still goes back to an pretty much exclusively oral tradition from family, friends, and family members, which makes it less credible than what we're trying to do.
So what's the, so you're trying to kind of expand the framework and say it's not just a, it's not just that classic kind of creation myth of a, of one kind of original genius creator and then a smooth transmission. You're kind of showing the complexity of the origin, or?
That's exactly it. Like, it's very difficult to do because we have 90 minutes to talk about something that's extremely complex and confusing for a lot of people. So that's one reason why we're taking so long. This script has been rewritten, I don't even know how many times now, at least 10 times. And it's because we have this linear view of martial arts and life, you know, and we know that takes something that you're very experienced in, whether it's academics, martial arts, or whatever. And you know, the things are not that linear. You don't learn from one person. You know, you learn a lot by yourself.
Yeah.
You learn a lot from your training partners. You learn a lot from observing. There's a number of different, you know, influx of information that we are bombarded with every day. And we're learning from all these things. So all these experiences play a role. So that top-down sort of linear interpretation of master teaching the student, like pouring the knowledge into the vessel, I think that's a very Hollywood-like approach. I think it's a very romantic approach. I think it's very idealistic. It's not realistic. You know, I, speaking for myself, I've had multiple teachers, but I say this without fear of offending anyone. It's, I feel very, like, very strongly about this. I have learned more from my training partners a lot of times, just by, not because they were talking to me, because we were going to war every day and they were forcing me to do things and think things in a way that I would have not have thought of had they not reacted to my actions. So yeah. That interaction, I call it an arms race, right? Mm-hmm. I'm trying to outdo you, do you try to outdo me? It's an arms race, right? Yeah. That's your ultimate teacher right there, right? But we do obsess over lineages. And I think that's part of the problem. And we're trying to explain that it's not so simple. You know, like the evolution of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is not linear. It's bushy. Yeah. It's like a bush. It goes in many directions. It goes back. It comes back. It picks up from judo. It picks up from catch wrestling. The rivalry with other with the Japanese plays a huge role in how BJJ is going to move away from its mothership, judo. I like to say that, you know, we shouldn't call it Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. We should call it Brazilian Judo. You know, when the Japanese saw Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, they're like, why are they calling it Jiu-Jitsu when it's clearly judo?
Yeah.
You know, that was kind of their initial reaction. This is just modified judo. Why are you guys calling it Jiu-Jitsu? Which meant something completely different to them.
Yeah.
You know, something far more archaic. And so that's kind of what we wanted to do. And not really take credit away from anyone, but give due credit. And it's not been easy because there's a lot of people. And no matter how good of a job we do, we're going to have to leave some people out.
Yeah.
The bush is too big, put it like
that. Yeah. So what was your primary research? How did you find the archives or know who to speak to or where to? I mean, how did you, because you're Brazilian, you can speak Portuguese, you can maybe read Portuguese. And so, I mean, did you go back and forth and look around different archives, or what was the process there?
So I became increasingly interested in the story. Out of the blue, ironically, like, history has always been a passion of mine since my childhood. My dream was to be an archaeologist, not a martial artist. I had my mind on archaeology for most of my childhood and youth. And, you know, Jiu-Jitsu took care of my life away. And at some point it came back to me. I remember, like, a student of mine asking a question why I didn't have a picture of Carlos and Helio on the wall like everyone else. So that kind of got the ball rolling. Mm-hmm. And I remember, like, once I started looking into this and Googling, I remember, like, seeing a book at a friend's house in Tennessee. It was called Shockey by Roberto Pedreira. It's available on Amazon. It's a big, thick volume. And the title is Shockey, the Untold History of Jiu-Jitsu in Brazil. Mm-hmm. Right? Or something. I can't remember the exact subtitle, but, like, that was the gist of it. And I'm like, oh wow, I didn't know there was anything like this. So I'm going through the sources, and there were a lot of sources that I didn't even know were available. A lot of sources that I would later learn were all from the Brazilian National Library, or at least most of them.
Okay.
Because the Brazilian National Library had digitized, like, their files, I think 2012. And that's sort of like the renaissance of jiu-jitsu history begins around that time, because prior to that it was oral accounts, or you can do the work manually. Right, like, go to the libraries physically yourself and go through them without the use of technology, which everyone knows is a lot more work. And some people had done that, but you're going to have limited results when you do that. You know, like, Fikiris in his dissertation, I think he did an incredible job with the tools that were given him. Yeah. He had to go all over the country to pick up news archives, and he found stuff that not even the Brazilian National Library doesn't have, right? There's some researchers in Brazil that had done the same. But I think the real boom starts in 2012 once those files are digitized and everyone had access to them.
Yeah.
So I went on to read, you know, all of, you know, Roberto Pedreira's books. Marcial Serrano does some really cool work in Portuguese. So I went on to read his books as well. Some of the same sources, in fact, different interpretations, but same sources.
Okay.
And then once I realized that most of these files were going back to the Brazilian National Library, I decided to do my own research there. And, you know, I didn't spend as much time in the library as these guys have, but I spent quite some time in there. I was able to find a few original articles that pertain to the origins of jiu-jitsu in Brazil, namely Mitsui Maeda promoting five Brazilians, possibly to black belt. We're not sure what rank it was, but very likely black belt. You know, none of them were Carlos Gracie, or any Gracie for that matter. So it's suggestive as to how the hierarchy was, you know, was set in Belém do Pará in the Amazon in Brazil.
Yeah.
You know, Carlos Gracie did not sit on the top of that hierarchy. It suggests that he was either at the bottom of it or not part of it at all. Oh. He's nowhere, as he mentioned. So that's, it becomes a little problematic. Later, we do find, you know, I find an article. Marcial Serrano finds the same article. We publish it around the same time. I think he might have published it a little bit before me, but like I didn't know about it until later. But is an article, the only mention of a Gracie during that period is a match between Oscar Gracie and Donato Pires dos Reis. Donato is going to play a very important role later in the story, but Oscar is probably Carlos. The reporter got confused, but most likely Carlos, possibly Osvaldo Gracie. But, you know, it's a mention of someone doing jiu-jitsu, a Gracie doing jiu-jitsu at the time, but they're mentioned as students of Jacinto Ferro, who was a student of Maeda. So right there, we already have a split in the lineage, right? Because if that indeed that was Carlos, it becomes clear that he was a student of Jacinto Ferro. Even though Maeda is present at the event, he is not mentioned in the association with Carlos, right? He's never mentioned as an association with Carlos. Everything is based off of Carlos' testimony. So this rewriting is, you know, it's based off of the works of other people, Pedreira, Serrano, Tufi, and, you know, and others, but mainly, you know, their academic work. So they were a huge inspiration for our production. And we just wanted to tell that story in a film format because we felt that, you know, most people, as you know, they're not interested in academic work. It's too heavy. It's too dense. People are bombarded with information all day. We're fighting for 30 seconds of attention, you know, from millennials. Like, they don't want to give you 30 seconds of their attention. So imagine 6,000 pages of academic work.
Well, but yeah.
You mentioned
Tufi Kairos and his work is, so I guess you know each other in the real world.
Yeah.
And his work is now beginning to be kind of published in English. And he wrote a PhD on the Gracies and the development of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And part of his argument, which I guess you're probably going to delve into as well in the film, is that really the Gracies were always clambering for position within Brazilian society, and they've always been quite clever, quite cunning players, getting themselves in the right place at the right time so that their name becomes kind of really dominant in relation to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu or Jiu-Jitsu in Brazil.
He uses a term there, patrician ethos. Okay. And I love that because I think he hits the nail on the head and says it very beautifully. It's the Gracie patrician ethos. And they have that. Like, they still do. Like, you can see they're very keen to keep their position in society. And now they call it protecting the family's legacy. And I think it's a great story. Like, I think that the family as a whole, it's a lot of people, but a lot of them were amazing people. Like, Carlson Gracie to me, like, you know, he's a superhero. You know, like, I think George Gracie was a very interesting character. Holmes Gracie seems like a very interesting character. And there are a lot of them that, in my opinion, have done more harm than good. You know, so it's, you know, like any family, you're going to get the good sheep and the black sheep. You're going to get a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they certainly had that sort of like elitist, you know, white European or descendants of Scottish, you know, and in Brazil, you have to understand Latin American politics. And Tufi touches a little bit on this. Latin American politics is very, very colonial. Like, it's not, it hasn't really gotten past its colonial period in some ways. The mentality remains colonial. What do I mean by that? We are Europeans, you understand that. I'm from Europe. You're really darker skin. You're one of the plebs over there. We're really the ones that should be in charge of the show. And if you pay attention to Latin American politics, that still speaks, you know, it's still very, very present in the mentality of the elites. And, you know, Tufi touches on that because it is, you can't miss it. Like, if you're from Europe or from the United States, or, you know, you just got a keen eye for this stuff and you visit Brazil, it screams at you. Brazilians don't notice it. Like, a fish would not notice water. Mm-hmm. But, you know, but they're so immersed in this mentality that they can't really, you know, remove themselves from it. So it's, and the graces are part of that. I'll give you an example. Like, if you're Brazilian and you have, you know, you have your mother's surname and your father's surname, like most Brazilians do, whatever name is more European sounding, that's the one you normally use. Okay. Whether it's your mother or your father, that's not the point. You're going to get the one that sounds more European. You don't want to use Silva unless you don't have a better option. You don't want to use Ferreira and Oliveira. You want to remove those, like the ones that are associated with, you know, with the lower ranks of society. You want to use the one that sounds German, right? Or sounds Scottish or sounds Italian, right? And it's something very ingrained in politics. And I think the Gracie family is just, they are an expression of that mentality.
Okay. Okay, so you might ruffle some feathers, I guess, the people who are really deeply invested in certain institutions and certain narratives around jiu-jitsu. There might be some controversy around this film.
You know what? There's information. You know, as a historian, you know this. Like, it goes like this: there are some things that we can factually know, and they're not controversial, even though they are at odds with public perception. So the public may have a given perception of the events, and it's something very ingrained in the culture. It doesn't mean they're controversial. You know, truth is not subjected to democracy, fortunately. The truth, it is what it is. It can't be controversial. There's some things we can factually know, and they're not up to debate. Other things there is some controversy. We have to weigh in both. And in those situations, you know, we're a little more careful. We kind of want to leave it up to the audience to decide. What we want to do is, when things are factual, like, for example, we can confidently say that Jacinto Ferro was Maeda's main student in Belém. We can confidently say that. That is not controversial, right? Carlos is not even mentioned. Unless he really was Oscar Gracie. And even so, it's like a very small piece of the puzzle, right? Jacinto Ferro was mentioned like every day in the newspapers. And there's like so many articles relating him to Maeda. But other things are a little more complex. So, for example, you can talk about the whether Carlos met Maeda or not. Like, that's a little more controversial. Like, there's no evidence for it, but there's some indications that he might have. You know, they've been in the same place more than once, and he was training jiu-jitsu, and how much training he did under him obviously is very unclear. We really don't know. We never will. But, you know, we kind of leave it more in the open. You know, things that could be argued either way. We live in a little more in the open, but we still wanted to present things as factually as possible, which is not easy to do because, you know, ultimately it kind of falls on me to be the judge. And because historians, they, you know, they have their biases too. They're going to lean more one way or more the other. Some are like very pro Gracie, some a little more anti Gracie. And I never wanted to be pro or anti. I want to be like, how can we make this story right down the middle, right? And that's what I've always wanted to do. And that includes giving the Gracie family credit for things that they never give themselves credit for, like resisting the expansion of judo in Brazil, which is far more important than their alleged gift to jiu-jitsu, which was, you know, evolving it technically, which they really didn't. You know, that's not true, but like, that's what they claim. But we leave it up to the audience. Like, we give the information to the viewer and we let them decide. And then some other things that are not really pertaining directly to the history of jiu-jitsu, they're more curiosities about the personality of Carlos and Helio and some other characters, we leave out of the story completely. They're completely removed from the story because even though they're like, wow, I didn't know that, at the same time, the documentary is not about them. It's about the history of jiu-jitsu. Yeah. So they, you know, their personal life doesn't make it there. Even though some historians will be really upset at us for not bringing it up because they feel it's relevant in terms of, you know, like giving a painting the personality of these two. And I just didn't want to get involved in their personal life because I think that was, you know, it was taking time away from important information regarding the history of jiu-jitsu.
Yeah. So you talk about information and facts and you want to get the record right and help people have a more nuanced and sophisticated understanding of a complex history. But it looks like it might be a rather elegant and beautiful film as well. Now, I come clean, right? I'm not I'm not a huge sports fan, right? Even things that I love, I don't watch. Like even when I was a kickboxer, I didn't watch the sport. But I love documentaries about these things. Like I don't watch much UFC, but I'll watch any documentary about the UFC. You know what I mean? Because I love what the camera can do and what the editing can do. And then the voiceover is going to be, and it looks like this film's going to have some quite sophisticated aesthetics and it's going to have a rather special feel to it. Could you say a little bit about that?
Absolutely. It's funny you say that because I feel the exact same way. I love MMA to me is like the ultimate form of fighting ever devised. Like I am absolutely in love with the technical aspects of MMA. I can't stand the culture. I don't want to be, I don't like the people involved in it. I love the art, but that the sport show business side of it, I can't stand. I can't watch the UFC. People give me tickets and I give them away. Like I don't want to go, but I'm like you, I'll watch a documentary on it like all day. But, you know, as far as the aesthetics of the film, like this is a really good story actually, because, you know, once I started reaching out to these researchers in Brazil, you know, the talks about a documentary had been thrown around. Like people had thought about it before as a bridge between the academic work and the audience. Right. So the film was meant to be, you know, that bridge that was going to connect the two worlds. Right, because you know this as an academic, you know there is a rift between the public and academic work to the point where people are suspicious of scientists and intellectuals. Yeah. They're like, oh, they're bad people. We don't want them to say anything because they don't know anything. You know, they're spending too much time in the library. There's always been a disconnect, right? So I think that film is a way of bridging these two worlds, and I truly believe that. So you know, Fabio, who is one of our researchers in Brazil, he was in touch with the crew in Virginia. And he's like, hey, Rob, I got these guys. They're really talented filmmakers. Why don't you have a chat with them? And I'm like, okay. So I give Jay Coleman a call. And, you know, we met in person over a seminar. And, it turns out he had a crew of, like, award-winning cameramen and guys that one of them had, like, won awards as a videographer. The other one, you know, had worked for the Red Cross as a documentary producer. You know, these guys have been involved in film their whole lives, and they were very, very talented, you know. And I felt that I tend to view the world as a historian. You're probably similar to me. Like, it's about the facts. If it's visually appealing or not, it's less important. To me, it's all about the information, right? I'm interested in what is it that you are saying. I love Pedrera's books. A lot of people don't like them because they're very dry. They're not written like novels. It's not a story. He's cataloging history. Right, so it's just information after information, fact after fact. To the average reader, that's not a good read because they want a story. And I think that had I not found a crew like them, it might have been very more informative than it's going to be, in fact. Right. But it might have been boring for the average person. Yeah. Right? I think they came in to balance things out because they have a very aesthetic and storytelling view and mindset. Like you have to engage the audience. Whereas my approach is you have to inform the audience, right? And it's been too mute. It's been like this. It's never been smooth waters, you know, because we differ. But it's working.
So I'm guessing that that you are quite a committed person. That you when you get into something, you get into it. And did you do what kind of crash course did you give yourself in like cinematography, filmmaking, editing considerations? I'm sure you were invested in all aspects of the process rather than not only the facts and figures, but like what is going to look like and what's it going to sound like. Did you take any special training or anything like that?
Here's what I tend to be very passionate about things that I'm getting involved in, and to my own detriment sometimes, like almost like I believe in myself too much, even when I shouldn't. Like sometimes I should be probably less confident than I am about some things, but in my head I could do it, you know. And of course I was aware that I needed help, and I think some of the problems we've had about the production have been in regards to my lack of knowledge, you know, and in the terms of filmmaking. And it's true, like I didn't understand the process. I still don't, to a large extent. It's my first time involved in it. Yeah. So I'm still a white belt in that regard. So that has been difficult. I'm not an easy person to deal with. I sometimes know that. But, you know, I do put my foot down on some things. You know, I think that I was a good balance for people who are experienced filmmakers, because I wanted to make sure that the correct history came across, regardless of it hurting feelings, regardless of it being politically correct. I'm not interested in political correctness. I'm not interested in pleasing the majority. I was always interested in giving people the history as accurately as possible. That was always my MO. Like, it's never been anything but that. So it was a good balance, but like, I had to learn a lot along the way. Like, I've always had appreciation for aesthetics. Like, I can read a novel or poetry and I can say that was beautiful, and I can tell you why I think it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. So it's not something I don't appreciate. I've always appreciated photography and videography. I can look at a shot and I think, man, it's so beautiful. I was just watching the other day Macbeth on Amazon. I don't know if you saw it. And I was just it's so good. So good. You gotta watch the shots. Like, it's some of the best I've ever seen. Like, the way they filmed the colors, like the angles, everything, right? So I can appreciate these things even though I don't have the experience in it, right? So as far as like the cinematography and like the beauty of it, and I think it will be a beautiful film. I think people will come across. I can't really take any credit for that. Mine has been more like, let's tell history. Okay. That has been my role in the film.
With regard to, I'm thinking about, I'm going to share another screen. You talk about film as a bridge, as a kind of mediating link. And I'm just wondering now, because you've gone online. I think that's quite a recent thing. Is this in response to the lockdown and the COVID-19 pandemic and crisis? Now, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is a very physical thing. It's very intimate. It's very... You really feel like you need that one-to-one contact in the class situation. So how do you think? I mean, how are you coping with the lockdown? And you've gone online. I mean, what's your angle on this? On how to teach and transmit and keep Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu alive in these very, very uncertain times?
It's a very good question, Paul. Like, you know, I just signed a lease on a building a week before the lockdown. On a new build, a new gym. So I'm paying rent. I'm about to start paying rent in a gym that has zero students and I can't even use, just to give an idea of how dire my situation is. So I'm not too happy about any of this, but you know, I try to stay positive. I'm doing what everyone else is doing. I'm trying to engage with my students online as much as possible. That's always been like my, it's the only thing we have, right? Basically, pretty much jiu-jitsu practitioners today, they're stuck with the two things they hate the most: warm-ups and positions. Those are the two things that everyone tries to avoid in practice. There are two things that people hate: warm-ups and positions. There are two things that people love, and this is what keeps people coming back: seeing their friends, the social interaction, the family feel. Right? I call it that social glue, that thing that keeps people coming back together, and like that. Those dynamics are something that are very, very attractive to people. Like, people like belonging. And the other thing is the rolling. You get the endorphins from it. Endorphins become highly addictive, as you know. Like, it's something your brain, if you give it to your brain every day, guess what? Your brain is going to want it every day. Yeah. So those are the two things we're missing. And this is why I've never been too optimistic about BJJ, being online martial art. Like, I think other martial arts it's easier if you're a boxer. I think so. You can do a lot of work by yourself. Or you do karate, there's a lot of things you can do by yourself.
Yeah.
Jiu-jitsu, you can't. You need someone's body. Oh, buy a dummy. It's not the same.
Well, it isn't. It isn't, right? So when I mean, I'm a white belt. I started Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in December after like decades of many other things. All my other things were punching and hitting. And this happened. And I just fell into a bleak and black depression because, like, how am I supposed to replicate this? And on only the other day, I thought, actually, you know, like, I know how to do the basic moves now. I know how to do an armbar. I know how to do a kimura. I know how to do these things. What I'm crap at, what I don't know how to do yet, is the transitions. So I've just ordered a dummy. I made one on Saturday, like a really bad one out of an old punch bag. But for someone in my position, between knowing nothing and being able to move around, this is I've got my mojo back again now, because I'm like, this is the stage I'm at.
And I can see that. I think that, you know, like, you're trying to get a fix, right? If you compare jiu-jitsu to an addiction, we're like junkies trying to get our fix, you know, like, what can I do? And I compare jiu-jitsu. I've always compared jujitsu to an argument, right? It's an argument. It's an argument with the body. I say this, you say that. We're arguing with our bodies, right? Okay. In an argument, you can argue for a long time if you got someone to argue with. But if you're by yourself, sometimes you do argue with yourself. I know I do. I spend a good portion of my day talking to myself. Yeah. But you can only do that for so long before you're like, okay, I'm ready to actually engage with people. Like I think we need that interaction. And if this, what is true for speech is true for the body and for jiu-jitsu in this case, like I think that we are missing that interaction. And I really think that there's going to be a cultural effect of social distancing in the BJJ community. I think it'll be more difficult to sign people up in the future because moms are going to go like, oh, we can't. Let's do something else that has less contact. I think contact is going to be – there's going to be a cultural toll on BJJ. I'll tell you why. My daughters already know they're not supposed to touch anyone. They're supposed to say hello from far away. They're 7 and 9. So we have an entire generation of children that are going to grow up more germophobic than we already were. Now we're going to be more than ever because social distancing is part of our vocabulary. 3 months ago – and you had never heard of social distancing. Now it's like one of the most used words in our vocabulary. Like you can go on Google Trends and say, how many times was social distancing used in 2019? Mm-hmm. And how many times it been like used in 2020? And then you can see that has been a norm that has been like, it has parachuted into society, right? And BJJ is the opposite of social distancing. So the hardcores will come back, but signing new people up will be more difficult. This has been single-handedly the biggest blow to the to BJJ in its history. Like I'm convinced, I can't think of anything that has done more damage to the sport than the coronavirus.
Yeah, but I guess it's early days. If they can develop treatments, if they can develop a vaccine, if they can, you know, what are you going to do? What are your plans? Are you going to switch to MMA, boxing, kickboxing?
I'm going to continue. I'm doing the same thing. I think that it's going to be hard, but not impossible. So my students have been surprisingly supportive. Like we lost very few members. I mean, let me take that. We had a lot of members freeze. We took a hit in members, but it was less than I was anticipating. I was anticipating losing half to all my members, and it wasn't close to that. So there was a hit. There was no doubt a hit. But you know, personally, financially, obviously, what you live with is taken away from you. So you're like struggling to break even, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, probably accumulating some debt at this point. But I'm gonna continue doing what I do. This is what I know I've been doing it my whole life. But it has been a bit of an awakening in the sense where you don't really think and realize how much you're dependent on BJJ to live, and so it's taken away from you, and you go, whoa, 100% of my income was dependent on this one particular thing. Talk about all your eggs in one basket, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm 38 and I'm thinking about, I wouldn't change professions, but I'm thinking of ways of like diversifying and not being so dependent on one thing for the future. I don't think I have a grand plan, to be honest, Paul. It's more like going with the flow. I think we'll be back to business sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
I think there will be a health impact. Some people aren't going to make it. But, you know, I don't want to sound so cutthroat, but this is the way of the world, and it's always been that way. Like, viruses wipe out a big chunk of the population. I think we're dealing better with this crisis than any other period in history. Like, we're doing way better considering the size of the world population. Mm-hmm. We haven't lost that many people when you compare it to other plagues in the past, like other pandemics in the past. Mm-hmm. So I think we're doing all right as a civilization. It's just that, you know, viruses have been at war with humans for hundreds of thousands of years. They're not going anywhere. I mean, we will be gone before they are. Like, viruses are here to stay. Like, they're not going anywhere, and we have to accept that.
Yeah. Well, I guess we should end on a happy note, and I think that, you know, maybe the film will come out and it will precipitate a revolution in people going, I'd never thought of Brazilian jiu-jitsu. I must seek out that Robert Drysdale's his club, and you know, maybe we'll all be millionaires by Christmas. I don't know.
That'd be nice.
But no, Robert Drysdale, yeah.
No, I'm sorry, just gonna no, and I hope I don't sound negative. It's never my intention, but I like the realistic approach to things, and I do think that, you know, we will survive as a martial art. I think there's going to be a temporary blow to the sport, but we will pick ourselves back up. We're just going a down moment, but we're going to pick it back up. And I'm not going anywhere. I know most of my students aren't either. And life goes on. It was a lesson. Like, it's like losing a match. That's all it is. Lost a match, pick yourself together, and let's move forward.
Okay. So the release date of the film, it's uncertain, but it could be the summer. It could be maybe the autumn. The fall, rather.
Very likely this summer. I mean, the thing is, you know, one thing depends on the other. I can't move forward with B until A is completely done, sort of thing, you know. Okay. And we're moving faster than we ever have. We really want to release it during the quarantine. Mm-hmm. And the plan is for this summer. And it's something, it's a film not just for Brazilian jiu-jitsu practitioners, for all martial arts enthusiasts. I don't care what martial art you practice. You've heard of MMA. You've heard of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, right? This is a story of MMA and of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu told in a way that, you know, most likely you've never heard of. So, you know, I hope that everyone enjoys.
Okay, Robert. Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
Thank you.